Penguin Random House Audio presents High Fidelity by Nick Hornby. Read for you by David Case.
The book bears a dedication for Virginia. Then, my desert island, all-time top five most memorable split-ups, in chronological order. 1. Alison Ashworth. 2. Penny Hardwick. 3. Jackie Allen. 4. Charlie Nicholson. 5. Sarah Kendrew. These were the ones that really hurt. Can you see your name in that lot, Laura? I reckon you'd sneak into the top 10, but there's no place for you in the top 5. Those places are reserved for the kind of humiliations and heartbreaks that you're just not capable of delivering. That probably sounds crueler than it's meant to, but the fact is that we're too old to make each other miserable, and that's a good thing, not a bad thing, so don't take your failure to make the list personally. Those days are gone, and good fucking riddance to them. Unhappiness really meant something back then. Now it's just a drag, like a cold, or having no money. If you really wanted to mess me up, you should have got to me earlier. 1. Alison Ashworth, 1972. Most nights we used to mess around in a park around the corner from my house. I live in Hertfordshire, but I might just as well have lived in any suburb in England. It was that sort of suburb and that sort of park. 3 minutes away from home, right across the road from a little row of shops, a Fiji supermarket, a newsagent, an off-license. There was nothing around that could help you get your geographical bearings. If the shops were open, and they closed at 5:30 and 1 o'clock on Thursdays and all day Sunday, you could go into the newsagents and look for a local newspaper. But even that might not give you much of a clue. We were 12 or 13 and had recently discovered irony, or at least what I later understood to be irony. We only allowed ourselves to play on the swings and the roundabout and the other kids' stuff rusting away in there, if we could do it with a sort of self-conscious, ironic detachment. This involved either an imitation of absent-mindedness, whistling or chatting, or fiddling with a cigarette stub or a box of matches usually did the trick, or a flirtation with danger, so we jumped off the swings when they could go no higher, jumped onto the roundabout when it would go no faster, hung on to the end of the swing boat until it reached an almost vertical position. If you could somehow prove that these childish entertainments had the potential to dash your brains out, then playing on them became okay, somehow. We had no irony when it came to girls, though. There was just no time to develop it. One moment they weren't there, not in any form that interested us, anyway. And the next you couldn't miss them. They were everywhere, all over the place. One moment you wanted to clonk them on the head for being your sister or someone else's sister, and the next you wanted to... Well, actually, we didn't know what we wanted next, but it was something. Something. Almost overnight, all these sisters, there was no other kind of girl, not yet, had become interesting, disturbing, even. See, what do we have that was any different from what we'd had before? Squeaky voices, but a squeaky voice doesn't do much for you, really. It makes you preposterous, not desirable. And the sprouting pubic hairs were our secret, strictly between us and our Y-fronts. And it would be years before a member of the opposite sex could verify that they were where they should be. Girls, on the other hand, quite clearly had breasts, and to accompany them, a new way of walking. Arms folded over the chest, a posture which simultaneously disguised and drew attention to what had just happened. And then there was makeup and perfume, invariably cheap and inexpertly, sometimes even comically applied, but still a quite terrifying sign that things had progressed without us, beyond us, behind our backs. I started going out with one of them. No, that's not right, because I had absolutely no input into the decision-making process, and I can't say that she started going out with me, either. It's that phrase, going out with, that's the problem, because it suggests some sort of parity and equality. What happened was that David Ashworth's sister, Alison, peeled off from the female pack that gathered every night by the bench and adopted me, tucked me under her arm, and led me away from the swing boat. I can't remember now how she did this. I don't think I was even aware of it at the time, because halfway through our first kiss, or my first kiss, I can recall feeling utterly bewildered, totally unable to explain how Alison Ashworth and I had become so intimate. I wasn't even sure how I'd ended up on her side of the park, away from her brother and Mark Godfrey and the rest, nor how we'd separated from her crowd, nor why she tipped her face toward me so that I knew I was supposed to put my mouth on hers. The whole episode defies any rational explanation. But all these things happened, and they happened again, most of them the following evening, and the evening after that. What did I think I was doing? What did she think she was doing? When I want to kiss people in that way now, with mouths and tongues and all that, it's because I want other things too. Sex, Friday nights at the cinema, company and conversation, fused networks of family and friends, Lemsips brought to me in bed when I'm ill, a new pair of ears for my records and CDs, maybe a little boy called Jack and a little girl called Holly or Maisie, I haven't decided yet. But I didn't want any of those things from Alice and Ashworth. Not children, because we were children, and not Friday nights at the pictures, because we went Saturday mornings, and not Lemsips, because my mum did that. Not even sex, especially not sex, please God, not sex, the filthiest and most terrifying invention of the early 70s. So what was the significance of the snog? The truth is that there was no significance. We were just lost in the dark. One part imitation, people I'd seen kissing by 1972, James Bond, Simon Templar, Napoleon Solo, Barbara Windsor, and Sid James, or maybe Jim Dale, Elsie Tanner, Omar Sharif and Julie Christie, Elvis, and lots of black and white people my mum wanted to watch, although they never waggled their heads from side to side. To one part hormonal slavery, to one part peer group pressure. Kevin Bannister and Elizabeth Barnes had been at it for a couple of weeks. To one part blind panic. There was no consciousness, no desire, and no pleasure, beyond an unfamiliar and moderately pleasant warmth in the gut. We were little animals, which is not to imply that by the end of the week we were tearing our tank tops off, just that, metaphorically speaking, we'd begun to sniff each other's bottoms, and we did not find the odour entirely repellent. But listen, Laura, on the fourth night of our relationship, I turned up in the park, and Alison was sitting on the bench with her arm around Kevin Bannister, with Elizabeth Barnes nowhere in sight. Nobody, not Alison or Kevin or me, or the sexually uninitiated retards hanging off the end of the swing boat, said anything at all. I stung, and I blushed, and I suddenly forgot how to walk without being aware of every single part of my body. What to do? Where to go? I didn't want to fight. I didn't want to sit there with the two of them. I didn't want to go home. So, concentrating very hard on the empty packs of cheap cigarettes that marked out the path between the girls and the boys, and not looking up or behind me, or to either side, I headed back toward the massed ranks of the single males hanging off the swing boat. Halfway home, I made my only error of judgment. I stopped and looked at my watch. Although for the life of me I don't know what I was attempting to convey, or whom I was trying to kid. What sort of time, after all, could make a 13-year-old boy spin away from a girl and toward a playground, palms sweating, heart racing, trying desperately not to cry? Certainly not 4 o'clock on a late September afternoon. I scrounged a fag off Mark Godfrey and went and sat on my own on the roundabout. "Scrubber," spat Alison's brother David, and I smiled gratefully at him. And that was that. Where had I gone wrong? First night, park, fag, snog. Second night, ditto. Third night, ditto. Fourth night, chucked. Okay, okay, maybe I should have seen the signs. Maybe I was asking for it. Round about that second ditto, I should have spotted that we were in a rut, that I'd allowed things to fester to the extent that she was on the lookout for someone else. But she could have tried to tell me. She could at least have given me another couple of days to put things right. My relationship with Alice and Ashworth had lasted 6 hours, the 2-hour gap between school and nationwide times 3. So I could hardly claim that I'd got used to having her around, that I didn't know what to do with myself. In fact, I can hardly recall anything about her at all now. Long black hair? Maybe. Small. Or smaller than me, certainly. Slanted, almost oriental eyes and a dark complexion. That could have been her or it could have been someone else. Whatever. But if we were doing this list in grief order rather than chronological order, I'd put it right up there at number 2. It would be nice to think that as I've got older, times have changed. Relationships have become more sophisticated, females less cruel, skins thicker, reactions sharper, instincts more developed. but there still seems to be an element of that evening in everything that's happened to me since.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?